It's you and I for now.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and get going.
All right.
Hold on, I'm trying to get going. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5055.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, we'll go through quickly and then begin the discussion of the community programs section of the Oregon Youth Authority budget, and you should have my handout for this. The governor's revised budget for the community program unit is $77 million in general funds. Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. The governor's revised budget for this unit is $77.1 million general fund and $104.2 million total funds. This is a general fund increase of 22.6% above the legislatively approved budget and a total fund increase of 42.4% from the legislatively approved budget. In this unit, we continue the minority youth transition program following the termination of the federal grant. We implement the behavioral rehabilitation services model for residential care. And the budget for this unit includes $10 million of the governor's $30 million juvenile crime prevention partnership. In the development of the budget, the legislatively adopted budget, 97-99, was $61.8 million general fund and $71.9 million total funds with 167.25 full-time equivalent positions. The emergency board made the salary adjustment, of course, for its receipt for all agencies. The Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Demonstration Project, the initial funding for that was program began the last legislature, was authorized by the emergency board. And there were funds allocated for the suicide prevention program following the Hillcrest suicides. Current service level issues, again, the position and inflationary cost changes. The phase-in for the Deschutes County pilot project for the full 24 months of the biennium. Foster care caseload and staff increases projected for the biennium. Adjustments to reflect the current federal funding levels in Medicaid, the percentage that the federal government will pay for such expenditures. And adjustments to the diversion program funding and provider payments to correct errors in the 97-99 budget. There are several packages in the governor's budget. Program reductions reduces the general fund by $4.3 million. Increases total funds by $12.1 million. Included in this package are the implementation of the behavioral rehabilitation services model, which accounts for the large increase in federal funds. A risk-based system of parole and probation supervision, which will allow the agency to reduce their cost of parole and probation. A reduction of the inflation rate on payments to providers, and a reduction in funding for foster care. The caseload is reduced. Package 101 is the $10 million for the governor's high-risk juvenile crime prevention partnership you heard discussed yesterday. Package 102 is $80,000 of general fund, $111,000 total fund, and two positions to correspond to the discretionary debt increase that was contained in package 202 that we discussed the other day to bring the agency's population forecast up to the funding up to the population forecast released by the Office of Economic Analysis. Package for $1.3 million would have funded mental health assessments for youth and juvenile justice system. It was recommended by the independent panel following the Hillcrest suicide. That is eliminated in the governor's revised budget. Package 104 has a minority youth transition program. This program served African American and Hispanic male youth released from close custody. The $400,000 in three positions continue the program following the termination of burn grants that had established it in prior biennium. Moving to the governor's revised budget, we have eliminated the package for mental health assessments, as I mentioned. We have an adjustment to equalize rate increase for residential treatment providers with the State Office for Services for Children and Families, which is required by federal regulation, and also the shift to a fee-for-services reimbursement model, which we began talking about the other day. And there are the elimination of three administrative positions. The result of the governor's revised budget for this program unit is a $1.6 million reduction in general fund, a $2.1 million reduction in total funds, and the elimination of three positions. What's missing from the legislative approved budget were the efficiencies in parole and probation through implementation of the risk-based assessment system that allowed us to cut the budget there. We have reductions in the foster care caseload and the elimination of three positions. And then the investment budget programs here, the juvenile crime convention budget, the agency participates in that is on the juvenile crime convention advisory committee, and of the $30 million, $10 million.
Okay, is there any questions? I have a question on item 103, the mental health assessment is $1,288,000. If we were to take some of the money out of the governor's $10 million application for students, I was trying to find it here, population forecast, so, anyway, there's some money in the governor's enhancement, $10 million of the $30 million of the governor's enhancement for youth juvenile prevention. If we were to take some of that money and fund the mental health services for youth, to me it seems like you're leaving out a major component, because these are possibly kids or youth that don't have health insurance coverage, that don't qualify for the Oregon health plan, and now we're giving them the third blow, and that's saying we're not going to give you a mental health assessment. Rather than massaging the problem, hoping that it goes away, maybe some of those kids sincerely need a mental health assessment to determine if they're acting out aggressions or acting out reasons that we can address, rather than say, well, we're not going to identify and deal with your problems, we're just going to lock you up and then eventually turn you loose to go back out and do everything all over again and only graduate you to the next level. So I guess the question I would ask is the $10 million general fund of the $30 million for the governor's juvenile enhancement, is that sacred funds cast in stone?
Mr. Pearson, the governor has certainly made a recommendation that he would recommend funding of the $30 million before funding the mental health assessments in this package, but why it was reluctantly removed from the governor's original recommended budget. I'm not sure I can comment on whether it's sacred or not, but the governor's priority was to attain the funding for the juvenile crime prevention package as a whole. This $10 million, as I guess I neglected to say, would provide grants to the county for services such as detention, shelter care, aftercare, graduated sanction, and supervision of offenders. In the overall priority of what the governor believes needs to be done for juvenile crime prevention as a whole, his choice was to keep the $30 million intact and reluctantly to delete the mental health assessment package.
Well, according to your statement here, Bill, it says the assessments will be provided in local communities. So I guess it's a trade-off of one to a local community of giving them an outright grant or providing a service.
That sounds an appropriate statement.
Yes. Senator Hammond, for the record, I'm Barbara McGuire, Assistant Director in charge of the Program Office for the Youth Authority, and I would also like to address that particular question. The funds that are proposed to go to the counties under the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program, I have read through, I believe, all but one of the county juvenile crime prevention plans, and the counties had the option, and some of them, in fact, did put resources toward a supplement of youth to make sure that they were as well aware of their needs and appropriate program planning as possible. So our belief is that the counties will have the ability and certainly the flexibility to do some of these same kinds of things within the context of the juvenile crime prevention plan. And
I guess someone has to take exception, because I come from a county with an O&T camp. Lost his O&T funding down to a place where it's very minimal support. All these functions, the human resources, youth authority, and everything else has been assessed and passed on to local government, and we haven't made the resources in fact, available to even carry out some basic essentials. Yeah, we're passing through some money to the communities, but there's a lot that needs to be done at the local level, and I think mental health screening are certainly a piece that we need to keep in perspective as we discuss this, because how can you say this young person deserves these kind of progressive sanctions unless you know what's causing that young person to act out that aggressiveness? I mean, they weren't born that way. They didn't start out that way. Something has happened in their life to make them that. And why not deal with it? Maybe it's not preventive, but at least it's trying in a sincere effort to break the chain of violence about saying, go out and do it, and then come back in here and serve time, and then go out and do it again. And I think we just need to cut the chains of bondage and say, hey, let's identify what the real culprit is here.
Senator Hannon, members of the committee, I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, that's a lot of the philosophy about why the crime prevention package was structured like it was.
And I understand that.
So that we could do the assessments on one end and then have the ability to provide the supervision and sanctions and so forth with the $10 million that's in this budget.
It clearly
is a cut for our budget, and in best of times, we would really very, very much prefer to have it in here. That's absolutely true.
Do you have any questions?
Very well.
No, I was talking. All right. Sorry, Bill. I had to preach my sermon up for the morning. For the afternoon now. Who else wants to speak now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jester, Area Coordinator for the Oregon Youth Authority. We concluded our discussion last Thursday with the facility programs. If you would again refer to the services and sanctions chart that we have in front of the table, today we would like to turn your attention to our community program section.
Which binder are we in? Are we in the small one?
We are in the binder with the picture of the youth on the front.
Okay.
For reference, we will be starting on page 39.
Page 39?
Under the program office tab.
Okay.
The community program section includes purchase services for pre-institutional youth who are on probation status, post-institution youth who are on parole status, and these services are coordinated and the youth offenders are supervised by OIA, parole, and probation staff throughout the continuum on the chart. In my facilities presentation, I referred to the pie chart that shows 45% of OIA's budget for facilities and 42% of our budget goes to community programs. Of significance, again, is the balance between those facility services provided by the Oregon Youth Authority and our community program services, which are contracted by the Oregon Youth Authority. This pie chart is repeated on the top left-hand corner of page 39. At this time, I'd like to introduce Barbara McGuire, who is the Assistant Director responsible for Oregon Youth Authority's program office. Barb will walk us through the program section budget presentation part of your book.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Bob said, for the record, again, I'm Barbara McGuire, Assistant Director in charge of the program office, and I am very happy to be here to talk to you about what I consider to be a very important part of making our services as successful as they can be. In all honesty, it's very easy to undo the good work we do in the institutions without the services and underpinning that the programs and community supervision wind up providing for those youth as they either avoid going to the institutions or actually in a more serious time in terms of things unraveling as they transition out of the community or out of the institutions back into the community. The goal of our community programs is to provide a series of graduated community-based sanctions for offenders. These sanctions and services are designed to provide reformation opportunities for youth, to prevent further penetration into the juvenile justice system, and also complement the institutional programs while helping the youth transition back into the community. I think the backbone of all of these services, if I might refer to it that way, is our parole and probation officer. If you look at that chart again, you'll see at the top it says case management, and the case management responsibility falls within the purview of our parole and probation officers. They're a lot more than an individual who monitors behavior and assures compliance with court orders. They clearly do that, but they also are very, very critical to the overall delivery of services for kids, and I'll talk more about that in a second. They also provide, we also provide to those individuals a variety of services ranging from residential care, foster care, and a variety of individualized services, all of which of these I will provide a little more detail to in a minute. The community programs for the Youth Authority are built on community partnerships so that we do the very best job possible at targeting services to kids who are at risk. We have a variety of specific county-based programs that we manage at one level or another in terms of monitoring county diversion as well as youth gang diversion. Again, I'll provide more detail about that in a moment. I think it's important to talk for a second about how we do business within the Youth Authority. Within the overview that Mr. Hill and Ms. Brazil provided earlier during our presentation, and I think Mr. Jester also talked about, we do work very closely with the counties in a variety of partnerships and linkages. As an example, we have talked about co-management agreements with a variety of counties which allow us to tailor our services and so forth to the needs of that community, the sensitivities of that community, and be as responsive as possible to the juvenile departments as well as the juvenile courts and the rest of the community. We are organized on a regional level, which allows us to be as responsive as possible, and as such, we make it every effort to interact directly with the public service agencies within those communities. We have intergovernmental agreements with 35 of the 36 Oregon counties, the exception being Marion County, for diversion of youth from the Youth Authority. That program has been in existence for a fairly long period of time. And one of the interesting constructs within that particular program is we have one consortium we work with that actually covers 17 of those counties in eastern and central Oregon. Also, many of the Youth Authority staff participate in the local communities in a variety of local public safety coordinating councils and their subcommittees and so forth. On other planning bodies, and I think that you will note if you look at any of the juvenile crime prevention plans that a large number of our staff were very intimately involved in the development of the juvenile crime prevention plans in the counties all around the state. In fact, I believe that there were participants, plural, in every single one, not just a participant, but we had several participants in many, many, many of the plans within the various counties. As I mentioned a moment ago, parole and probation services is absolutely the backbone of what we do in the community. The goal of parole and probation is to enhance public safety by supervision of youth and offering those youth opportunities to reform by designing individual treatment, reformation plans, and coordinating appropriate resources within the community. The parole and probation officer is the responsible person to monitor the youth behavior, but also, and this is very critically important, to make sure the reformation plan is carried out. I think that we've talked about the reformation plan in the past, but I think it is also important to reiterate that the reformation plan winds up being that blueprint for those things that will assist the youth in being accountable, being held responsible for his or her behavior, being safe in the public arena, and also learning some things and developing some skills and abilities so that they can reform and potentially not commit additional crimes.
Can I ask you, is this community programs from probation services, and you list the goal there and then the services, is that the current practice?
Senator Hannon, yes, that is current practice.
Okay. How can you identify one of the issues is opportunities for reform by designing individual treatment and reformation. Along with that would be mental health evaluation. And It's easy to say you're developing a plan, but how comprehensive is this plan?
Senator Hannon, members of the committee.
I'm not a psychiatrist. I just have a very deep feeling.
I appreciate that.
About a lot of people's problems to be solved if they were identified.
Senator Hannon, members of the committee, we have a program within the Youth Authority called Individualized Services that allows us the flexibility to provide those kinds of assessments as necessary. The other piece that I would suggest is that as youth are observed within the institutional settings, we wind up gathering a fair amount of information, and some youth do in fact come to us with assessments from the community. Certain categories of youth do come to us with assessments from the community.
Is there drugs and alcohol treatment included in the individual plan as necessary?
Senator Hannon, members of the committee, absolutely is. We do drug and alcohol assessments as indicated, and if necessary, the youth who, if identified with that particular issue, will receive services to the extent, of course, that they're available. But we make every effort to make sure those are available and that we can purchase those if necessary, yes.
Okay. As an example, you have an OYA facility in Grand Pass. But if a youth over in Jackson County is sentenced, does that person go to OYA in Grants Pass, or are they expected to live under county sanctions in Jackson County?
Senator Hannon, members of the committee, it's a depends question. In some cases, a youth will be adjudicated to probation in the community under the county juvenile department and, in fact, may stay in Jackson County under the juvenile department jurisdiction. In some cases, the court may find that the criminal behavior was serious enough or there's been no success in other forms of sanctions so that the youth would be committed to the Oregon Youth Authority and, in fact, might reside under those circumstances if necessary within the Rogue Valley facility in your area. In some cases, the youth may not be so serious that he or she requires being incarcerated in a youth correctional facility, and they may go to a private residential treatment provider over which we have.
Who makes that determination, the sentencing judge? Or is there another screening process in place that identifies where a person is recommended to be?
Senator Hannon, in most jurisdictions, and I agree that this would be the case in Jackson County, there is a multidisciplinary committee that reviews an individual case before that case goes to court, and there would be a recommendation being made to the juvenile court based on the degree of public safety risk that the youth provides, what the treatment needs are, what the family strengths are, whether or not the recommendation should be for probation with custody to OYA for placement in the residential facility at the community level, or whether, as Ms. McGuire pointed out, the criminality and or the treatment needs are so high that the youth needs to be committed to a secure facility, and that recommendation is made taking into account input from mental health, schools, juvenile department, OYA, SCF, and other community providers that may have been working with the youth or the family.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Todd, if you'd like to continue, please.
Thank you. Parole and probation officers have a variety of very important responsibilities. One of them, as I mentioned, is they design and implement the treatment and accountability plans for delinquent youth. And part of the point of that is so that they can assure that that particular individual is in compliance with the orders of the court, which in many cases are things that you would expect in terms of not being not committing any more crimes, but also include things like going to school, participating in treatment, staying away from victims, curfew. Those kinds of things often will be things that the court imposes in terms of conditions. The parole and probation officer is critical in terms of coordinating the various purchase resources, such as the need for residential care, foster care, various individualized services, which might be treatment-oriented or other kinds of things. Parole and probation officers in the community recruit and develop our foster care resources so that we have a variety of available out-of-home situations for youth who are unable to return to their homes. One of the things I think is essential in it is a very different thing from the adult correction system, which I'm certain you are somewhat familiar with, if not very familiar, is that we try to deal very closely with families to the extent that that's possible. And the parole probation officer winds up being a critical link to making sure that we don't lose track of the fact that families can be a meaningful part of the reformation of these youth, and that many of these youth will be returning home. And the parole probation officer is a link to make sure that that happens in a way that continues to help manage that youth, to hold the youth accountable for their behavior, and also to assist in the ongoing process of treatment and reformation. And finally, we work in partnership with the local juvenile departments to make sure that whatever plans are done with a specific youth meet the needs of the youth and the community as far as the issues of accountability and reformation.
Okay.
One of the things that's a little unusual that I would like to mention, however, with juvenile corrections that is very different from the adult system, I would point out, is that our POs take responsibility for managing youth in terms of monitoring and so forth throughout the entire continuum for us. And that means, for example, a youth may enter the youth correctional system on probation on the right in that chart. No, it's actually your left, I'm sorry. On your left, may enter there, and a parole and probation officer would have responsibility. May unfortunately penetrate further into a youth correctional facility and then out. But PO stays with that youth the entire stay through our system. And the reason for that is our experience has found that that continual case management assures a greater level of success and more likely will provide a seamless service delivery so that we don't wind up dropping pieces. The reason that's very important is that transitions between kinds of custody and freedom and not freedom are the places where things fall apart the most rapidly. And it's our experience and our belief that addressing that by carrying those POs with those kids throughout the entire experience with us minimizes the problems of transitions being the places where the failures occur.
It would be a little helpful if we had a breakdown possibly of what the county support level is versus what the state level of support is. So we can look at different geographic areas in the state and say community is responding and this one isn't. Maybe we need to identify those communities and try to help them in a mode that they can better utilize Oregon Youth Authority.
Senator Hannon, members of the committee, that may be difficult to get, but we'll do our best.
Okay.
If you'll turn to page 41, one of the resources that we provide through the Youth Authority for youth who need this level of care is residential treatment services. And principally our goal with the residential treatment services is to provide assessment and residential treatment services that facilitate a youth offender's return to a productive community and family life while continuing to ensure that it's safe. We purchase a large number of residential and shelter care beds around the state using a combination of general fund dollars and federal Medicaid funds under a category which was referred to earlier in the overview as Behavioral Rehabilitation Services, which I know that you like acronyms a lot, but I'm going to do one here because that's a tongue twister for me. We call them BRS at the Youth Authority. BRS supports skill building and counseling services along in a therapeutic environment that are intended to provide positive change in a youth's life. BRS is not intended to do mental health treatment, which we will continue to access through the Oregon Health Plan, a very important adjunct to our ability to provide services. And it is not available to provide for room and board, which is largely what our general fund support winds up being for residential treatment providers.
Can Mr. Chairman, can you break down the amount of youth that you treat, you just mentioned Oregon Health Plan. there's a lot of kids that are probably part of the system of the Oregon Youth Authority that are not on the Oregon Health Plan, nor are they on any insurance plan. So when they need treatment, how is their treatment given to them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I don't know the precise percentage of youth who access the Oregon Health Plan out in the community. It is clear, however, that those youth that are within a correctional facility are not eligible for Medicaid-type services, and they are supported through general fund within those institutions.
So if you incarcerate them, they can get treatment. And if they're not incarcerated, technically, if they don't qualify, they can't get treatment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I hope not to mislead you into believing that if you're incarcerated, treatment is available, and if not, that's actually not the case. We do our very best to provide treatment. In fact, that's the reason for not only the residential providers, our ability to access the Oregon Health Plan, and our services, about which I'll speak in a few minutes. We do our very best to provide an adequate level of treatment services within the resources available, and I believe it is fairly well done on the community level as it is in the institutions.
Well, are you talking about facilities right now, like Cynthia Springs, where you buy bed space and a facility for young people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, yes, Lithia Springs and a variety of other residential providers throughout the state, yes.
Okay. And a person is troubled in Lithia Springs was referred there by either the youth authority or the sentencing judge or whoever was sending that person to the Lithia Springs program. Who gives the assurance that that young person will receive treatment versus the person that may not need it so much and probably gets more attention? How do we define who gets it and who doesn't?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the parole and probation officer's role is to monitor cases and make sure that those youth that are in various residential programs or other settings, for that matter, receive those treatments and other services as necessary to achieve their reformation. It's absolutely a critical piece of their role. It is certainly possible, although I think not frequent, that there may be some breakdown in that, but I believe that the parole and probation officer is the key to making that effective and make that work.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, additionally, when we describe the multidisciplinary team that would review a case and make a recommendation to the juvenile court judge, a similar or same committee would review the reformation needs and the public safety needs of a youth for referral to one of our private providers. And as part of that process, the assessment of what the individual needs were and that the provider's ability to meet those needs, taking into account whether or not the youth were eligible for the Oregon Health Plan or not, and whether additional funding through flex funds would be needed to ensure that the level of service that the youth required was able to be provided by an individual program. Additionally, the program would screen that youth and enter into the process of determining whether or not there was a match between the need and the ability of the program to meet that need.
Okay, thank you.
Will we answer your question, Senator?
No.
You want to explore it a little bit?
No, I want to highlight you were testifying on another bill, and I wanted to highlight for you that I think that one of the governor's proposals is to set the $10 million aside for the $30 million package on juvenile justice. And then at the same time, the recommendation is to delete 1,288,348 general funds for mental health services for youth. And it funds mental health assessments of youth in the juvenile justice system. And I'd rather take some of that $10 million that's just going to be turned back to the counties and to help them assist I give them an additional tool to have to screen some of these kids, rather than just creating a revolving door. Go in the front door and right out the back door and go right back to whatever you're doing without trying to intervene. In the meantime, to break that vicious chain that has them all bound up. I'm not trying to sound like a bleeding heart, but it doesn't just...
I've found out my own kids. I can't discipline them and send them forth
and do well by saying, don't do it again, I'll stay away from you. Well, then the next time, don't do it again, I'll have to take it away from you. Well, when do the sanctions really kick in to where the child or the young person understands what sanctions are? And, you know, if somebody has a problem, there's no better way than to screen them and say,
you know, it's like these kids down there in Colorado. I mean, they had a whole year of planning on this.
You can't convince me that somebody in the course of 1 year didn't notice these kids were doing something, obviously, to do something out of the norm. I mean, they just didn't do this spontaneously. And if we're going to be effective in having a strong, good youth authority, then I think we need to be the tool and the mechanism to help interface with local government, particularly county youth departments and juvenile judges and others, to say, let's do some analysis here on these young people and identify what the problem is and deal with the problem rather than the symptom.
You want to respond? Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, yes, I would. Sadly enough, there is a lack of availability and accessibility to some mental health services for youth that have not committed a crime and come to the attention of a local juvenile department and begin this process of more formalized assessment and referral to agencies. Additionally, I want to provide the information we're having to you specifically ask the question of the youth in substitute care that were eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and all of the youth in substitute care are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan.
Because they're not, if I can, because they're not living at home?
That's my understanding.
Is that the screen? I mean, is that simple? They're not living at home, so they qualify for eligibility?
I'm seeing a positive head nod from our experts.
Representative Kozanski.
Are we actually talking about the level 7 classification of kids? Or are we talking another group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozanski, we are not talking about level 7 youth being served at the current time by the Oregon Authority. We are talking about youth that have been adjudicated on law violations.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might speak to this a little bit more. In 1996, the Oregon Youth Authority, in a partnership with Mental Health Division, did a fairly extensive study of mental health needs of youth that come to our attention. And, in fact, there was a recommendation made out of that to fund a group of programs that were all interrelated with each other that was around $7 or $8 million. This is the remaining piece of that package, the $1 million that you referred to, Senator Hannon, and that is because we believe that it is the very most important piece of that entire package. We absolutely agree that mental health needs of youth are a critical factor for us. We find that a large number of our youth, if you remember the two heads facing each other, a large number of our youth have significant chemical dependency issues, have significant mental health issues, and other issues that make it very difficult for them to remain crime-free. And this is an area that we also believe is very important.
Mr. Chairman, I just raised that so the staff and yourself and perhaps other committee members, we can look at that when we go into work session.
All right, I appreciate that. I think it's a good time to break. We have 25 expert witnesses that have just arrived from afar, I believe, from Adler's country. I could have slipped and said 25 experts on juvenile crime that arrived to testify on behalf of the jail. I didn't mention that.
Just credentials.
Yeah. And by the way, it was going over the internet, so almost anyone can have access to this.
They know you're here now.
But remember that individual that was walking across the hallway that I said is, that's Mr. Dave Cook, he's the director of the Department of Corrections. You guys are batting 1,000. This gentleman sitting over in the chair here that's about ready to stand, this is Mr. Rick Hill. Stand up, Rick. Give him a, he is the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. That's Oregon's version of
junior jail.
Yeah, junior jail. So you don't want to know either of those gentlemen in a professional capacity whatsoever. So anyway, Chris, is there a spokesman for your group? Is there a student spokesman?
Why don't you stand up right there?
Yeah.
In the blue berets. Yes, stand up. We have an important question. We spent a lot of time on this, and we can cut right to the chase. Should we give more money or less money to the Oregon Juvenile Jail? Great answer.
There you go. Hearing no opposition, we are adjourned. Thanks for saving us all the time. And thanks for coming over and participating in the project. Literally, seeing democracy. This is a committee process. This is where most of the work is done. We appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to dance with their enthusiasm for the youth authority, but would you prefer we take it out of schools?
Well, now, we're not getting it. That was a very sophisticated answer. That was a great answer. My hat's off to you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. DRS is a huge change for us, and we're very, very excited about the prospect of full implementation of that. What it does for our residential care system is basically four changes for us. It increases youth services requirements dramatically. It increases that each of our providers must provide a minimum of 13 hours of skill building activities and or counseling each week, and that is documented for each youth. Additionally, a variety of other things are required, including recreation, education, school counseling and other kinds of things, and these are all defined within that particular law and must be documented. DRS requires transition services from the residential program that a youth is followed and services continue to be provided for a period of 90 days after they leave a residential provider. A third change that is quite different from what we've experienced in the past is that there are mandated staffing levels in terms of numbers of staff that are required on each shift, as well as minimum qualifications, experience, and training for those staff, something that we haven't experienced quite to the degree that this expects in the past. And finally, all the social service staff, or those counseling kind of staff, are required to be off-post. And I think that most of you know what that means, but for some of us who don't, what that basically means is they don't have to work a shift where they are the entire that they are supervising you, but that they are in a position where they're dedicated to providing counseling and other kinds of supportive services to assist in the reformation process with the youth. Youth Authority has three different kinds of residential programs that come within this particular definition. We have approximately 390 beds of residential treatment, and that is a network of youth care centers throughout the state, and you will find them literally throughout the entire state that provide 24-hour-a-day residential services to delinquent and behaviorally disturbed youth throughout the state. The services focus on providing structure and supervision for those youth and provide that within a therapeutic environment. And they, as I said, provide a variety of services, including skill training, educational support, and those kinds of things. We have approximately 20 beds of residential alcohol and drug treatment. And, of course, along with the other kinds of things you'd expect to find in a residential setting, those particular beds are provided to use to deal with the chemical dependency issue. And finally, we have approximately 75 beds of professional shelter care programs throughout the state. These are 24-hour per day facilities that are designed to provide assessment for youth, stabilization for kids who are out of control, and also give us the ability to provide short-term treatment services so that we can make a more final decision about placement for the particular youth in question.
Any questions? Is there an actual stopping point?
Sure.
There it is.
Who licenses these beds?
Excuse me, Senator Tim?
Who licenses the beds that you have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tim, the beds are actually licensed by SDF.
Just checking on the chief, if you told me right.
Thank you.
SDF, thank you.
Mr. Chair? Just following up on that, why is that still within their area? If these are kids that are coming out of the youth authority. I think they're under the control and jurisdiction of the youth authority.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the history on that.
What's your question, maybe? When, Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, when the Oregon Youth Authority Services were separated from the Department of Human Resources, there was one FTE that was associated with licensing, and that FTE stayed with SDS, and so OYA did not receive the staffing with which to do it. And so we've relied on SDS to continue that function for us.
If I could follow up, is that relationship going, let's say, accordingly to a mutual work agreement and satisfaction to the department needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zansky, when we separated from the Department of Human Resources and SDF, we did have an intergovernmental agreement that spelled out responsibilities, and I am hearing that, by and large, that is going all right.
Thank you.
We do have one other kind of out-of-home care that I want to spend a moment on. If you'll turn to page 42, we have within the Youth Authority a system of foster care that provides services to approximately 320 youth in a given day. Foster care, I suspect you're somewhat familiar with foster care, if not very familiar. Essentially speaking, what we have is a system of homes in the communities that provide traditional family living environments for youth who don't have otherwise appropriate living circumstances. They don't require the more intensive services, generally speaking, that residential care would indicate. And the intent, by and large, is to provide an opportunity for youth to continue to prepare themselves for their transition back into some kind of either independent living or to return home. But it's more of that normalization process so that youth can get back into the community as a regular productive citizen within the community setting. To augment that service, and frankly, to augment, potentially augment, any other kinds of community-based services, we have something that we refer to as individualized services, which, or excuse me, yes, individualized services, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes, because it helps us to make this work even a little better than simple foster care money. The second piece of out-of-home care, if you will, and that probably doesn't address the, or doesn't describe it very well, is we administer a program called Independent Living Subsidy, and what that is a program that allows us to provide short-term financial subsidy for specific youth who are ready to live independently within the community, who cannot return home, and no longer need the additional support that foster care or residential care or whatever might provide for them. So those are two other kinds of living situations that we have available to us that continue the process of transitioning youth back to their full and total independence within the community. If you'll turn to page 43, I'd like to talk also for just a second about individualized community services.
this is a unique program, I think, from the standpoint that it is very, very flexible. In fact, in the profession, it is referred to frequently as flex funds. What it really is a wraparound service with the goal of augmenting and assisting those programs such as foster care and other kinds of out-of-home care in providing those individualized services that a youth might need. It is rare that you can just take a program and plug a youth into it and presume that that program can deal with any kind of issue that ever comes up. This allows us to have the flexibility to do individualized case planning on a very, very much one-on-one basis. It allows us to purchase a variety of services that sometimes assist the youth to be more effectively placed within a residential setting or maybe remain within their own home. Typically what happens with these funds is that a multidisciplinary team that Mr. Gester spoke to will look at various kinds of requests that a parole and probation officer or other case worker may see as potentially useful to assist in the reformation and make some determination about whether or not that makes sense in the overall reformation process, and then make those recommendations. And the kinds of services can be anything from a one-time service or one-time purchase, or it could be an ongoing specialized treatment. And places that you might find this kind of thing are with kids who have the non-traditional kinds of needs, for example, or may not have other kinds of, we may not have other kinds of resources for. Another kind of individualized service that I think assists us with a population of kids that can be quite difficult are those services that are addressed specifically toward gang diversion and transition services. We provide funding to address the very specific needs of those kids who are identified as gang involved, and the intent of those programs is to divert youth from coming into the youth correctional system, and on the other end of the continuum, as you again see in the chart, is to help transition previously gang-involved kids back into the community so that they don't have to be involved with the gang culture any further. At this point in time, all the funds that are involved in this particular program are targeted toward Multnomah County and support a variety of residential and outpatient community services, as well as providing enhanced supervision and case management services to assist in those youth not returning to the gang lifestyle.
So, Barbara, from inference then, I take it you'd support the funding of the, YAG Laser?
Mr. Chair, yes. In fact, that's been a very effective program, we believe, in terms of assisting kids getting away from those things that unfortunately label them by virtue of a physical appearance. Absolutely.
And that YAG Laser, I mean, I know there's a lot of volunteer time in both professional and lay time dedicated to this at $60,000 price, but the YAG, and all that does is the darker colors. Do you have any idea what the multicolor, the lighter color unit would cost?
Mr. Chair, in following up from the testimony yesterday, it is my understanding that from Dr. McCarthy, the $60,000 that was presented before this group was in fact to provide a pool of dollars to purchase time on the more sophisticated laser equipment that would remove colors, and additionally to fund cosmetic surgery on tattoos around the eye that you cannot use a laser to remove but actually requires a surgical removal. So the money would be to access the more sophisticated laser equipment and to pay for procedures that are not currently covered with the volunteers or the laser that they bought with the original grant.
Well, that's a very comprehensive $60,000.
Yes, sir, that's my understanding.
Okay, I just wanted to follow up on that. I know we funded in the past, and I have no doubt there's been a value to have done such to gang issues in Multnomah County. I mean, how myopic is that? How big a problem is it outside Multnomah County? Or is it cropping up? And more specifically, Senator Timms wants to know if there's any in Burns and Bend.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you would refer to page 15, which I believe was in the introduction overview, there is a chart that shows to the best of our ability where youth gang members within OIA's custody have come from. And I believe that when Mr. Hill did the overview, he talked about some of the difficulties in maintaining good numbers in this population set. Part of that is a result of what gets adjudicated, what becomes part of the record, how police reports are written, whether or not there is supporting information that accompanies the use to OIA's custody that indicates gang involvement.
How representative are these numbers?
Mr. Chair, there...
I mean, that's who you've got behind bars. I understand that. That really wasn't my question. I mean, the question is, so let me phrase it differently. On a per-county basis, does this representative distribution of gang members behind OIA bars, do you feel, subjective question, do you feel that's a representative depiction of the, quote, magnitude of the issue?
Mr. Chair, I think in response to your question, that it is representative of the criminal activity that youth gang members are involved in the community based on the number that are coming forward to the youth authority's custody.
Yes, I it bothers me about that. I don't know why. I mean, it's just somehow I think Marion County is actually higher. I mean, I recognize the population isn't quite as much as Multnomah, certainly, but I think they're more than half the problem of Multnomah. I don't know. It's just a gut level feel stuff I'm talking to law enforcement. Anyway.
Sure, if I could elaborate for the record, Rick Hill, Director of OIA, distinctly keep UK numbers. And we used to display their chart in our budget document. We stopped doing that because two reasons. The labeling reason, first reason, many jurisdictions stopped calling them gangs because of the liability of doing so. So we felt the numbers were invalid. But in fact, the numbers had reached well over 5,000 on a statewide basis. This is just a small portion of those youth who actually come into our system, and we know they're gang members because they admit to being gang members and it's documented in their records with their gang membership. The problem with the other problem with the numbers from the state police is that they did not break them down by age. So a youth gang member to the state police, a gang task force, could be as old as 25, 26 years old. They didn't break it off at age 18. When we asked them to do that, they said it's roughly about a third of them are under the age of 18. So we're talking about thousands. In terms of this county proportion, I cannot say that this is or is not representative of the overall gang problem in the state of Oregon. These are just the ones that come into our system.
But and I understand all the vagaries you just told me. I mean, but roughly speaking, we've got 5,000 gang members in this state, and you've got 170 of them behind bars. That's what I just heard you say.
Again, it's not against the law to be a member of a gang. There are many self-professed gang members who are attending high schools all across Oregon every day. The criminal activity stems from that. That's our opinion.
Okay. Sure.
Representative Patrick.
So this is an aside. I know that the labeling of gang members as a perceived or real problem. Is that a federal problem, a state problem? Can you answer that? I think it's important because we move forward and I think that there's some merit to identifying gang members within communities or gang affiliates or whatever. Can you address that?
Sure. Representative Patrick, my answer would be that it's a problem on all levels of government. It's a problem to the federal government who attempts to prosecute gang members based on the RICO Act for organized crime. I mean, they have to know who gang members are and who they aren't. It's a problem on the local level
in terms of mapping out what the community needs are and what kind of interventions to put in place with the limited dollars they have.
But from a liability.
From a liability standpoint, I think it's, I can't speak to the federal government. I know there's a sensitivity to it at the state level. And I believe that in Multnomah County, it is particularly a sensitive issue. Within their listing, within the list of patients, or any company that's up there, my father's a member of that. So I guess it's a multi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I think Rick's comments are absolutely right that in Multnomah County, one of the concerns had to do with the attachment of race and gang identification together and the propensity on the part of the public to see them as being synonymous, and that poses a problem.
And skews reporting numbers.
We'll talk about that later. It's just not a big deal. Just something doesn't seem 100% right there. But that's
on page 44, the county diversion program, the county diversion program description. The goal of county diversion is to provide communities with resources to purchase delinquency intervention services to meet the needs of youth who otherwise might come to the youth authority. This particular program has been around for a fair amount of time and is one of the methods by which we provide partnership opportunities with the local communities. Funds are offered directly to counties to develop and operate a variety of community-based programs that hopefully avoid OIA commitments. At this moment in time, 35 counties participate in diversion, with the exception being Marion County. All have an intergovernmental agreement with us to participate in this program, and I think I mentioned a little while ago, one of those intergovernmental agreements is actually with a consortium of 17 Eastern and Central Oregon counties. A variety of services are purchased with these dollars, ranging from enhanced supervision, sex offender treatment, alcohol and drug treatment, a variety of assessment services, individualized services similar to what I mentioned a little while ago, variety of job counseling opportunities, and provide a fairly significant underpinning to a variety of services out in the community. The other community program that exists within our budget is the Deschutes County Pilot Project, and this particular project is one we're working with Deschutes County on, and an effort to promote community justice and develop local facilities and programs that address public safety. What they're hoping to do is provide enhanced local options for at-risk youth and potentially take any savings from decreased drug use and put that into further juvenile crime prevention.
Decreased drug use and lower cost drug use.
Mr. Chair, presumably so.
Yeah. It pulls the jury still out on that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
You add it all up.
That's correct.
And it blows me away, all the work that everyone's put into this, you know, Rick and Scott Johnson and myself and Senator Bryant, and we've got this whole big book and we're a little footnote, you know, down at the bottom there. Somehow it didn't seem just. But then you had, you know, color or lights or...
Get the laser.
Yeah, if we get that laser print, you know, we take the colors from the lasers we've removed from the tattoos.
Okay. Mr. Chair, actually, the picture on the left margin of page 44, we should affiliate with the Deschutes County Pilot Project. If that would make you feel better.
Oh, yeah, that's your brother.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's my guy.
Well, sure. Right.
Let us pretend it's lower down on the page.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Jim. We'll talk about that maybe a little in detail on work session. But, thank you.
If you'll turn to page 45, the program office is charged with providing quality assurance and contract compliance for the variety of agency programs that I talked about previously. One of our other goals is to provide technical assistance to Oregon juvenile justice community, including county juvenile departments, courts, and other partners, as well as with other youth authority staff and in a variety of programs. We basically provide services in the following ways. We provide services in terms of full probation support. This is intended to provide support to the various field staff, including full probation officers and other affiliated staff. We do the criminal background checks on prospective foster care parents. We ensure support, child support orders are collected, and that those are maximized so that we get the greatest amount of revenue for support programs as possible. We do sex offender registration, provide treatment support for sex offender treatment, alcohol and drug treatment, fire setters, and other kinds of specialized treatment that we provide not only in the community but also within the facilities. And we also are liaison for interstate compact for juveniles, which is the legal method by which kids change jurisdiction from in-state to out-of-state and out-of-state into the state of Oregon. Another service that we provide within the program office is the community resources unit. We talk a lot about the things that they're involved with. Principally, what they do is monitor the contracts for the various residential treatment services that I talked about earlier. They monitor, evaluate, assist in program development, and those kinds of things. And one of the new things that we have piloted that was mentioned in our overview a few days ago is that this group of individuals will actually conduct the performance-based standards review of the Youth Authority Correctional Facilities. Right now we're participating in a pilot, and it's very promising. We're looking very much forward to the full implementation of that for all of our facilities, and we'll be very, very intimately involved with that particular project.
Where is that pilot?
Mr. Chair, the pilot actually includes 8 of our correctional facilities throughout the state. We are part of a national pilot, and we are notable in that all the other projects in other states are a single facility, maybe a single detention center or a single youth correctional facility. And we made the choice that it would be most beneficial for us if we did the pilot by including our entire youth correctional facility system. So we have 8 facilities involved. Throughout the entire state, and the McLaren Hill Press and so forth.
Okay. I want to back up just a little bit to your juvenile sex offenders.
Do you have any data indicating the recidivism rate for juvenile sex offenders versus adult sex offenders or comprehensive treatment programs and what those may or may not provide us in terms of reducing recidivism rate for juvenile sex offenders?
Mr. Chair, I say with some pride that Oregon does an excellent job of sex offenders in both the adult and the juvenile system. Having come from the adult system over 2 years ago, one of the areas that I worked in was specifically with community-based programming with sex offenders, and as such, I found that our recidivism rate was somewhere hovered between 10 and 11% with sex offenders who were released to the community. That's phenomenally good. We recently did something I would not refer to as research because it was not as in-depth as a formal research project, but we did look at every single sex offender that we have had come through our system for 10 years. And what we did with each of those youth is did a law enforcement data system check on their records to see if they had come up with another sex offense. And what we found is that the recidivism of the youth that we've had come to us is less than 5% in terms of a new sex offense. I feel that's in large part because of the treatment we offer, because of the supervision strategies and other things that we have going on in this state. I think Oregon can be proud that we do an excellent job with sex offenders.
That's how many released sex offenders over what period of time?
Mr. Chair, we looked at in excess of 100 youth over a period that had been with us for a period of 10 years. Starting with youth one, we looked at a 10-year period on youth one and so forth, and found that the recidivism was less than 5%. One of the things that's very important and very a little different about sex offenders, which is why these long periods of time are very useful in looking at their reoffense history, is that unlike other kinds of offenders, they tend to remain crime-free earlier. I think you saw that chart, and it specifically reoffend within the first 3 or 4 months.
That's not the pattern that happens with sex offenders, whether they're adult or juvenile. They tend to be able to be crime-free for a longer period of time, and the curve is a little bit different. But I feel very confident looking at a 10-year sample, our 10-year, it wasn't a sample, it was the entire group of kids, that we have a good history with treatment and supervision of kids with them.
How long have you been looking at the 100th kid that had left the institution?
Mr. Chair, admittedly for a short period of time, because that youth could have been released within the last 6 or 7 months, in all honesty. It's my intent that we continue to track that because the public wants to know, policymakers want to know, does it make a difference? And we will continue to periodically check up and make sure that what we're seeing now continues to be the case. And if not, we'll make mid-course corrections on our strategies.
Was the distribution of your 10 years fairly well scattered, year one, year two, year three, year four, so you're not getting some skewed results based on we really haven't been studying these kids long enough?
Mr. Chair, there will be a skewing, and it has to do with a law and policy change that took place, and it has to do with ballot measure 11, to be honest with you. The youth who 10 years ago might have stayed within the juvenile system on a sex offense may more likely go into the adult system and then go on to adult prison. Those are kids that we won't be in a position to keep track of as closely because they go into another system. It's certainly possible for us to do that. It's just not something we've done at this point. It may change to some extent what that curve looks like. I would be remiss in totally predicting what it's going to look like because I don't really know.
That just seems incredibly low. I mean, 5% based on what I'm hearing about sexual predators, sexual perpetrators. Okay, I hope you're right. You want to jump in, I can tell.
Mr. Chair, that would not include youth who may have been returned to our facilities for non-sex offense behavior. And the level of community supervision that this particular population gets is very intensive. Not only do they have more frequent contact with their parole and probation officer, we are purchasing community-based treatment for these offenders when they leave our facility. And if they begin to slip in treatment, that may in and of itself be grounds for return to a facility prior to an offense. We also do routine polygraphing of this population to ensure that they are not beginning to violate other conditions of their placement agreement that would lead them down the path to a higher exposure to repeat offensing. So those are some of the elements. Additionally, this is a population that tends to stay within our youth correctional facilities for a longer period of time in the reformation program, and the treatment within the facility that's focused for sex offenders is fairly intensive. So those would be some of the elements that would contribute to the lower rate of sexual offending bringing them back into institution.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to piggyback on that. That is normal supervision and treatment behavior for Oregon correction systems. That's how we do business in this state. That combination of things is the critical piece. Specialized supervision with behavioral control programs, treatment programs, with polygraph, sex offender registration is a piece of that. Those things allow us to be as successful as we are. Many, many, many of the other states do not use that particular group of techniques to manage sex offenders, which I think is why their recidivism is not as good as ours. We just plainly do a very, very nice job of working with a difficult population within this state. We're looked on by other states within Oregon as being something of an expert in the area of management of sex offenders in the community system.
Okay.
To go back to page 45, one of the other responsibilities of the program office is that we manage and administer training and development unit for the youth authority. And this particular unit provides safety, security, treatment, and management training to youth authority staff and is an important link to providing many of the same kinds of training
to the rest of the juvenile justice system, juvenile detention centers and so forth around the state. The final piece of the program office is Program Development and Evaluation Unit. This particular section of the program office provides planning for various programs for youth offenders in both the facilities and community. We develop grants and monitor those, as well as other federal programs. We monitor the classification system for offenders in the closed custody facilities within our system. We collect data to keep track of the performance measures. We do any of the youth story research that takes place. We coordinate all the mental health and physical health care services from an administrative point of view for the youth authority, and finally have responsibility for coordination of all the agency rules and policy development. This particular unit of the organization is administered by an assistant director, who is me, and I oversee the activities of the program office.
Any questions for Barbara to this point in time? Brace ahead, you're doing great.
Be okay. I'd like now to speak to, starting with page 46, our reduction packages. Reduction package number 90 is a foster care reproduction that will reduce our foster care budget by some, we believe, through the co-management agreements and various partnerships from the community, that we can actually reduce the average current service level, as indicated in the text there, from 420 ADP to about 330 ADP. Our second reduction is related to the change in how we provide resources to residential treatment under BRF, and I'd refer you back to the description of that, and also remind you that this particular direction was authorized by the emergency board in a prior action, but makes a fairly significant general fund savings, at the same time bringing in a significantly greater number of federal funds. Also in reduction package 90, we are proposing a reduction in parole and probation supervision on page 47. What we propose could have been done by restructuring parole and probation, just cutting kids off at a certain point in time. We made a decision that really didn't make very much sense for us, in fact might not well, so serve public safety. So what we decided to do is make these reductions to a more organized look at how we deliver parole and probation services. And what we're going to do is implement a classification system that, in fact, rolls toward a risk-based supervision model with structured responses to various noncompliant behavior, so that we are enabled to provide the greatest level of supervision to those kids who are at the greatest risk to reoffend out in the community. Exactly how this will take place is unclear to me, because what we want to do to make sure that we do this right, if you will, is work closely with our community partners to make sure that it meets the needs not only of the youth authority in terms of our ongoing service delivery to kids, but also the local communities in which we work. Reduction package number 90 continuing is an adjustment within the inflation that was in the governor's recommended budget. That's fairly technical for me. To the program option packages, we have a couple of those. The first one, which is on page 49, program option 101, is $10 million in the governor's crime prevention strategy. And this $10 million is referred to as basic services support, and provide subsidies to the local juvenile departments to allow them to provide a variety of basic services. The things that we are seeing and were envisioned within this particular package are things such as detention, shelter care, assessment services, aftercare, graduated sanctions, and additional supervision. We believe this is critical because these particular kinds of services, if not available, make it difficult to have a totally sound juvenile justice system, and without the services may in fact increase the number of kids who come to the youth correctional facility and other OIA services instead of either stabilizing or actually reducing those.
you know, I'll be talking long and hard about this.
So. Page 50, policy option package 102. This is a companion piece to a policy option package, I believe it's 202, in relationship to the facilities, that allows for a bed capacity increase due to the forecast. This is the companion piece in that it adds poll and probation support that are directly related to an increase in our facility capacity so that those youth can transition effectively back into the community. On page 51 is policy option package 103. This is specifically the nearly $1.3 million related to mental health services for youth.
This is what Representative Senator Hammond was discussing earlier.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. We recognize that there is a very high prevalence of youth who come to the youth correctional system who either have substance abuse problems or various other mental disorders. Mr. Hester has the report that we did with Mental Health Division that outlines the prevalence of the issues and also outlines the recommendations. This particular package is just a small part of a very much more robust package that was proposed within that particular report. That report referred to approximately $7 million. We withdrew the remainder of that, and believing that this was the most critical piece of that report, brought this forward. What we had hoped would happen is that this particular package would be available to provide more thorough screening after the initial assessment that can take place that begins the process of identification, to do more precise work around special needs of kids, whether that be, you know, health needs, educational needs, those kinds of things, allows us to provide better assessment of the needs of specialized populations, firefighters, sex offenders, kids who are chemically dependent, those kinds of specific things, and also enable us to make more specific treatment recommendations.
And Margaret, was this just after the suicides, September 5th?
Mr. Chair, actually, no. We had this before. We have a convergence of things that took place that lead us to this particular policy package. This particular report was done with the Youth Authority and Mental Health Division at the request and direction of the e-board and or actually not the e-board. We were directed by the 95-97 legislative session to do this and was presented to the e-board. This also, the convergence piece here is the Hillcrest suicides, which just heightened even further our need to do something significant within the area of mental health. And this is the thing we thought was the most significant.
Well, I will never forget Rick and Representative Shetterly and at the time Representative who's your senator now?
Pardon?
Yeah, Peter. It was at that very table right there.
That was some of the most dramatic testimony I'd ever heard.
Mr. Chair, you may recall from the House Judiciary hearing following the Hillcrest suicides, we were asked the question why we had not sought funding for the elements in this report. And we believe that the assessment is a critical underpinning of the work that is done with youth, particularly with the increased number of youth that are entering our programs, both on the community program side as well as the facility side, that have diagnosed mental health needs.
I believe Representative Schrader has a question.
A question. Do you do any assessments of the youth now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, we do. When youth come into our facilities, they are given a mental health risk assessment, and then they are referred as a result of that mental health risk assessment to a psychologist or a psychiatrist for a more in-depth and full evaluation. The difficulty is on the front end with youth that are still in the community and are coming into our facilities.
that we have not necessarily been able to do good work in providing a mental status on them.
Anything to prohibit the use of the $10 million juvenile crime prevention partnership money from being used in this area?
I want the one-word answer is two words. Hopefully, we'll be able to use part of that $10 million plus some others. I mean, and you were out of the room. By the way, we all apologize up here. I mean, we have the house is winding down on days that they can hear bills, and so we're all planning, you know, rotating chair, committee staff, whatever. Anyway, Senator Hannon was delved into that in detail, I think, and I will talk with this one.
On page 52, policy option package 104 gives the Minority Youth Transition Program. This particular program is continues to be in our budget and is intended to be a program to represent or to address the disproportionate minority confinement issue within our youth correctional system. This does basically is allows us to continue this program. It was started in 1996 when we received grant funds from Criminal Justice Services Division to implement a program that was intended to be a multi-systemic, culturally appropriate aftercare program, very specifically for African American males. And those kids are in Multnomah County. As time has gone on, we've in fact expanded that program to include not only African American males, but Hispanic American youth as well. We're very pleased with this program because we are seeing a very significant decrease in repeat criminal conduct, in recidivism with those kids. We did a study, or Portland State University actually did a study for us that found that of the youth that had been through the program 3 months after release, the project participants had recidivated at 14% as compared to 32% for a similar group of kids who had not been through the program. What we're asking happen is that this program be continued from the general fund dollars, and we will hope to continue to provide services to both Hispanic and African Americans. What we anticipate is that we'll serve around 35 kids per year within the program context.
Hold on just a second, Barbara. We were going to finish early, but Representative Schrader showed up, so go ahead, sir.
Does the county, you indicate it's mostly for Multnomah County or all for Multnomah County, does the county kick money into this at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, the county does not provide money for this program. This is a program that's operated by a youth authority. It is entirely a Multnomah County program. There are also services provided on the county level, however, that may be complementary to this. Mr. Jester is from that area and may be able to provide a little more information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I believe that you heard yesterday during public testimony a report from Multnomah County talking about their contribution to working with over-representation issues in Multnomah County, and they also provide targeted money for minority populations.
I think we're in the home stretch. If you'll turn to page 53, essentially speaking, 53 is a detail of what we've been talking about in terms of the dollars. What you see is a column that talks about the current service level, the governor's recommended budget, and then on page 54, the various packages and revenue sources. On page 55, the comparison that you see there is the difference between the governor's recommended budget for community programs and the governor's revised budget. The adjustments within the governor's revised budget are essentially listed on page 56 and are basically three things. Our elimination of the mental health assessment package, which is policy option package 103. An equalization of rate increases for residential treatment providers with SCF, and a shift, a state savings that's resulted from the shift to fee-for-service,
And the final cut that you'll find within the governor's revised budget is elimination of 3 positions in the program office.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You are looking at a rare occurrence in the legislative universe. Hold on, I have a question, but it's not for you. Did you go fast?
There's more testimony coming.
I got mine, Dad.
You didn't ask me.
I don't remember anyone asking. Nor do I remember anyone calling on you.
We'll have to move for reconsideration on representative.
Yeah, I think we should. Anyone have any questions?
I mean, because what I'd like to do is adjourn out and just kind of sit around and informally talk about the closing statement.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, we have a video, if time permits, and if there is interest in response to a question really raised by Representative Patridge about what the youth authority was doing in terms of any kind of prevention work to prevent youth from shooting heavy 11 type offenses. And we talked about a partnership with a film that was made out of Multnomah County with a film arts grant, and we worked with the county to have the film translate also into Spanish. And we have that with us today.
Sure, absolutely.
Great.
Grayson, you can come and watch it. $2.50 popcorn. Where's this from, Medford?
That looks like band production work to me.
Are you from Portland?
Public County.
Measure 11 is a shocking law. I mean, it's very, very strict. And I don't think that the youth that are in on Measure 11 crime really understood. And well, certainly not trying to commit the crime. And perhaps not even stop the court experience, but they really didn't understand what was happening.
Measure 11 was passed by the community person of the violent crime for Oregon. So a man named Kevin Mannix wrote about Measure in 1994 about enough people to sign a petition to get it on the ballot.
We hope people will get the message that it's not acceptable to hurt other people in our society, and that would deter some people from going out and hurting other people. Secondly, we wanted a speech representative so that people who had already been predators, who had been hurting other people, were pulled off the streets so that we could incapacitate them, pull them out of circulation. And during the time that they're incapacitated or out of circulation, we also hope that we have enough time to work with them to rehabilitate them.
Measure 11 creates mandatory minimum sentences and drive 15, 16, 17 year olds from the North Fork to certain times. Measure 11 takes away the deadly power to give someone a lesser sentence and treats all offenders the same, whether it's their first offense or whether they're repeat offenders.
We tried to select crimes that were at the upper level of the scale of violence. for instance, within the walls, there are four levels of assault crimes, and they chose the top two levels. So we were trying to reach the most violent crimes that affect the dying.
I didn't know you about it. cost to commit the money to build these systems and to operate these systems, and there was no funding source in Measure 11, so that means that money is coming out of things like primary and secondary education, and different programs for young kids, and other things that could have much greater effect in terms of keeping people out of the system in the first place. That's one of the consequences.
Impose more serious consequences on parents that really need it, and it will also provide more training in terms of the victims and not the victims.
How do you take yourself? I'm not sure you get answer before you get into it.
Okay.
And to wake up, Measure 11's out there, and you can just in 5, you can do it in 5 or 10 months.
I mean, you're thinking about the doing these crimes, just think about. Think about what they're doing before they do it, because, you know, they may look at Measure 11 right now and say, well, it never happened to me.
This is the place you want to live. You want to live with 30 other people, no privacy.
It's all the things they experience in that life. You know, like, you go through your high school prom and everybody graduating.
In 7.5 years, stuck in this situation. They don't want to be in this situation, you know. There's no hope. You do what you gotta do all your time, and there's no hope.
Whether or not you like Measure 11 or even believe in it, you need to educate yourself about it so that you or your friends and family doesn't get thrown underneath it. One good way to stay away from Measure 11 is not to commit the crime in the first place. The best way to sum this video up is to say, where knowledge power, power is free.
Representative Passage.
Mr. Chairwell, I appreciate the video and seeing the address to Kevin Mann for speak on video. My concern is still is that while this is maybe educational and maybe has some preventative app, you know, some educational and I guess prevention kind of message, in terms of being proactive, it's somewhat proactive, but it's not something that I see as PSAs, and we talked about the 1020 Life program, those kinds of things. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see what what the authorities had an opportunity to see what California's done, Representative Ashington has all those 30-second spots that California did in terms of their 1020 Life program. Their program's been reasonably effective in some of those kinds of things in terms of educating the public in a scared straight kind of attitude. And with as much money as we're spending on juvenile crime and juvenile crime prevention, it seems like some of those types of materials might be appropriate in, you know, not even dealing with necessarily with Measure 11 or whatever, but just in dealing with a scared straight kind of approach to funding.
Well, you know, that obviously wasn't a PSA,
no.
But it does done with kids in the system with a grant from the Arts Council or,
exactly.
I mean, that's, you know, that's actually, give them the money, let them go. They produced what I think would be a great piece in school. Was the governor added later? Was he edited in?
I don't remember the sequence. They interviewed me and Representative Mannix and the governor at different times. I think this took about 3-4 months in the production. I didn't know you were going to be on it. I don't know that we were all clued in as to exactly what it was. It is, of the three videos that were done, one by the Association of Oregon Industries, one by this group, I think the third one came out of the Attorney General's office, I don't know who funded it. This is the one we get the most requests for from school. We can't keep this one in five. Some subtitles in Spanish. This is the one that is reaching the youth because it involves the youth and kids are the ones telling the story. We have not priced out what it would cost to produce the 60-second or 30-second PSAs, and I haven't seen those, but from California. But we'd be interested in doing that if we, you know, if it was money to that, but I think it would be very, very helpful to get them all around the state. Because it isn't just the kids that need to know about this, it's also the parents. I don't think the parents see these.
I just was curious. When I've seen this tape, and of course I have a copy of it. I didn't remember seeing the Kitzhaber press conference clip in the version that I'd seen. Maybe they were there and I just didn't pay as much attention at the time. That's why I was wondering whether or not that had been revised at some point. Because what this is it's more than a warning about Measure 11. Then there's a discussion of second look, although there's not a heavy discussion of it.
Well, you're talking about second look.
Oh, yes, I was asked about it. And I'm not questioning that. I just, of course, those are probably news conference statements that were at a store. They may just have gotten a copy of a Kitzhaber news conference. The question I have is, if you're getting so many requests, why don't we put together some sort of a further videotape to make available to the schools and try to include that in our budget package so that we can get further word out? We can also talk about public service announcements and try to use some free radio and TV time, but there's sort of two phases there. One is getting tapes out in the school. I know that the Attorney General at the time, Kulongowski, was interested in putting together and did put together a piece. I think that was the one with the AOR funding. But that's just a thought.
That's a good tape. I like that a lot. What else have we got for our distinguished witness panel? Does Rick, you want to make a closing statement? Or?
I think we're done for today. For tomorrow, we have administration and capital construction to wrap up. And then we'll bring up follow-up questions when we come up to the board.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.